everybody. This is Jean Barta with the Custer's Luck Radio Show, and it is Monday, May 11th, 2015, and I'm happy to be here with you this evening, especially after the debacle of the metro melting down this morning here in D.C. and Northern Virginia. I was already at work when everything happened, and my boss wasn't able to get in until 10:30 in the morning. Then I left early for some out of the office appointments, and which required me to go on the metro. And although allegedly it was all fixed, they were quote single tracking on the blue, yellow, silver line. Blue, orange, silver line, I take that back. And it took me 30 minutes to go 15 minutes on the metro. And even on my way home a little while ago, it was still a little slower than usual. So I'm happy to be here on time. This evening I'm going to be talking about the battles of Namazine Church and Sailor's Creek, and also along with talking about George Armstrong Custer, I am also going to be talking about his younger brother, Thomas Ward Custer, who by early 1865 was a lieutenant in Custer's orbit, his older brother's orbit, and actually he was one of his aides de camp. In any case, let me get started. Guests can call me at 646-787-8231 and also go online via the Blog Talk Radio website. Simply go to my episode pages on Blog Talk Radio and guests can find this particular show and come on online. And then I will also add that there are many other episodes for listeners to peruse on their own time that are already archived, and this particular show will be archived after I'm finished this evening. Let me get started. The Union victory at Five Forks spelled the end for Confederate Richmond. The rebel supply lines were cut, and Robert E. Lee informed Jefferson Davis that further defense of the city was untenable. The army and government fled west. Federal forces gave chase, trying to prevent the Army of Northern Virginia from linking up with Johnston's army, which was withdrawing before Sherman's forces into North Carolina. The Cavalry Corps rode hard, attempting to stay ahead of Lee's retreating troops, and Custer was in the van, skirting the Confederate left, anticipating the inevitable shift south toward Johnson. Colonel Newhall of Sheridan's staff penned a description of Custer in these final frantic days, and I'll read this below. At the head of the horsemen rode Custer of the golden locks, his broad sombrero turned up from his hard face, the ends of his crimson cravat floating over his shoulder, gold galore spangling his jacket sleeves, a pistol in his boots, jangling spurs on his heels, and a ponderous claymore swinging at his side. A wild daredevil of a general and a prince of advance guards, quick to see and act. Seeing him pass by, a stranger might smile and say, "Who's that?" As he noticed his motley wear, his curls, and his quick, impetuous way, but would wonder to see him in the thick of a fight. For Custer loves fighting and hated his enemies then. Newhall also described the general's war fighting during the pursuit as, quote, Custer against the world. The men of Lee's once lethal army were still ready to fight if they had to, but they were on their last legs, and the further they fled, the more hopeless their situation seemed. No Confederate soldier who was on and of that fearful retreat can fail to recall it as one of the most trying experiences of his life, Robert Stiles recalled. Trying enough in the mere fact that the Army of Northern Virginia was flying before its foes, but further trying, incomparably trying, in lack of food and rest and sleep, and because of the audacious pressure of the enemy's cavalry. The retreating units were crowded onto a few muddy roads, short of food and ammunition, cold and tired. General John B. Gordon, who commanded at the leading edge of the Confederate flight, wrote, "Fighting all day, marching all night, with exhaustion and hunger claiming their victims at every mile of the march, with charges of infantry in the rear and of cavalry on the flanks, it seemed that the war god had turned loose all his furies to revel in him, in havoc." So, based on that description, let me now transition to actually talking about the Battle of Namezine Church. That battle, the Battle of Namezine Church, was an engagement between Union Army and Confederate States Armed Forces that occurred on April 3, 1865, during the Appomattox Campaign of the American Civil War. The battle was the first engagement between units of General Robert E. Lee's Confederate Army of Northern Virginia after that army's evacuation of Petersburg and Richmond on April 2nd, and units of the Union Army, which consisted of Army of the Shenandoah, Army of the Potomac, and Army of the James, under the immediate command of Major General Philip Sheridan, who was still acting independently as commander of the Army of the Shenandoah, and under the overall direction of Union General-in-Chief, Lieutenant General Ulysses S. Grant. The forces immediately engaged in the battle were brigades of the Cavalry Division of Union Brigadier General and Brevet Major General George Armstrong Custer, especially the brigade of Colonel and Brevet Brigadier General William Wells, and the Confederate Rear Guard Cavalry Brigades of Brigadier General William P. Roberts and Brigadier General Rufus Barringer, and later in the engagement, Confederate infantry from the division of Major General Bushrod Johnson. The engagement signaled the beginning of the Union Army's relentless pursuit of the Confederate forces after the fall of Petersburg and Richmond, after the breakthrough at Petersburg, fall of Petersburg, which led to the near disintegration of Lee's forces within 6 days and the Army of Northern Virginia's surrender at Appomattox Courthouse, Virginia on April 9th. Captain Tom Custer, General George Armstrong Custer's brother, was cited at the Battle of Namezine Church for the first of two Medals of Honors that he received for actions within 4 days. And let me go transition here to my next narrative section. Okay. Okay. Most of Lee's army marched west on routes north of the Appomattox River, but the remnants of the division of Major General George Pickett and Major General Bushrod Johnson, the latter of which included the brigades of Confederate Brigadier Generals Henry A. Wise, William Henry Wallace, and young Marshal Moody, along with Cavalry Corps Commander Major General Fitzhugh Lee, whose division was under the command of Colonel Thomas Mumford, and the division of Major General Rooney Lee, following as a rear guard, moved on the Namezine Road south of the river. While most of Lee's armies had an effective one-day head start on their flight from Richmond and Petersburg, the advanced Union Army Cavalry and Infantry Corps under command by Major General Philip Sheridan were able to keep Lee's forces to their north by pursuing them on a parallel course to their south. Union cavalry harassed and skirmished with Confederate units almost from the outset of the Confederate Army's march from Petersburg. Confederate rearguard dismounted cavalry units often paused to block the roads from pursuing Union cavalry. As early as the evening of April 2, 1865, Confederate cavalry under Fitzhugh Lee detected units of the Union Cavalry Division of Brigadier General Thomas Devon in pursuit and had Bushrod Johnson's infantry throw up a series of breastworks along the Namazine River in order to repulse the Union riders. On April 3, 1865, advanced units of the Union cavalry fought with rearguard Confederate cavalry at Willowcomic Creek and the Battle of Namazine Church. In the early morning of April 3, 1865, at a ford on Namazine Creek, regiments from the 2nd Brigade, under the command of Colonel William Wells of Custer's 3rd Cavalry Division, which had taken over the advanced pursuit, threatened the rear guard of Rooney Lee's column. That rear guard was the cavalry brigade of Brigadier General William P. Roberts and a few infantry units. Roberts had dismounted the 4th North Carolina Cavalry Regiment and the 16th North Carolina Cavalry Battalion and had them entrench on the west side of the creek. George Armstrong Custer brought up artillery to blast the North Carolina cavalrymen with canister and had the 1st Vermont Volunteer Cavalry Regiment ford the creek out of sight of the Confederates in order to outflank them. When the Confederates discovered this maneuver, they fled their position in order to try to regroup further down the road. Custer's division then crossed the creek and headed for Namazine Church, about 5 miles away. The leading unit cavalry brigade of Custer's 3rd Division, the 2nd Brigade under Colonel William Wells, who had attacked the Confederate cavalrymen of Brigadier General Rufus Barringer along the creek, fought a running battle along the road until they reached Namazine Church. Barringer's Confederates, the 1st and 2nd North Carolina Volunteer Cavalry Regiments, with just a single artillery piece, with the 5th North Carolina Volunteer Cavalry Regiment in reserve, counterattacked the 8th New York Volunteer Cavalry Regiment of Wells' brigade, commanded by Major James Bliss, as they reached the Namazine Church. After sharp fighting, the Confederate cavalry were turned away by the 8th New York Cavalry, and reinforcements from the 15th New York Volunteer Cavalry Regiment, commanded by Colonel John J. Coppinger, and the 1st Vermont Volunteer Cavalry Regiment, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Josiah Hall. About 9 a.m. on April 3rd, as Wells' brigade began their attack, Brigadier General Custer's younger brother, Captain Thomas Custer, spurred his horse over a hastily thrown-up barricade of the still-deploying Confederate cavalry and captured 3 Confederate officers and 11 enlisted men, as well as the battle flag of the 2nd North Carolina Cavalry. For his actions, Tom Custer would eventually be awarded a Medal of Honor, one of 2 he would earn within 4 days. Barringer's Confederate cavalry had bought enough time for Bushrod Johnson's infantry division to pass nearby Namazine Church around 8 a.m. Unfortunately for Johnson, his forces took a wrong turn at a fork in the road and had to halt when his command breached a bridge over Deep Creek that was underwater from recent flooding. Although the Union cavalry drove off the Confederate cavalry, the North Carolina cavalry regiments had secured the Namazine Church Road intersection long enough for Johnson to return and take the correct fork. When General Johnson approached with his infantry division, George Armstrong Custer's forces were forced to retire, allowing the Confederate forces to proceed across Deep Creek and Appomattox River tributary. Then Fitzhugh Lee and his cousin Rooney Lee, the second son of General Robert E. Lee, separated the cavalry commands, and continued their retreat. George Armstrong Custer later chased the fleeing Confederates, but near dark he ran into substantial infantry opposition from Johnson's division at Sweathouse Creek, and then decided to halt for the night. After dark, however, Wells's brigade continued to attack Fitzhugh Lee's force along Deep Creek. Brigadier General Barringer and many of his men were captured by Sheridan scouts who were wearing gray uniforms and who led Barringer and his remaining men into a trap. Rooney Lee's adjutant general, Major J.D. Ferguson, also was captured. Sheridan's forces camped for the night along the road from Namazine Church to Deep Creek, while the Confederate infantry and remaining cavalry continued to march to their designated consolidation point of Amelia Courthouse, where they expected to receive much-needed supplies and rations. Colonel Wells lost 95 Federal cavalrymen killed and wounded in the engagement. Total Confederate losses are not known, but George Armstrong Custer's men were able to capture many of the Confederates. They took 350 prisoners, 100 horses, and an artillery piece while initially clearing the road as far as the Namazine Church. Johnson reported 15 wounded from his division. After the battle, Namazine Church served as a field hospital and later as Major General Sheridan's temporary headquarters. The aftermath of the Battle of Namazine Church. On April 4, 1865, the opposing forces skirmished at Tabernacle Church or Beaver Pond Creek and at Amelia Courthouse. Meanwhile, Sheridan's forces occupied Jadersville, Virginia, and Burkeville, Virginia, which blocked Lee's access to the Richmond and Danville Railroad and to the direct road southwestward. General Lee had hoped to find a supply train at Amelia Courthouse, Virginia, 39 miles southwest of Richmond, but when he and his forces arrived there on April 4, 1865, he found that the train contained only ordnance, ammunition, caissons, and harnesses. After a delay for unsuccessful foraging efforts, or as some historians have argued, primarily because of the delay in bringing up a pontoon bridge crossing. After a delay for unsuccessful foraging efforts, or as some historians have argued, primarily because of the delay in bringing up a pontoon bridge needed to cross rain-swollen rivers, Lee had to order his hungry men to resume their march in the hope that they could find rations at Farmville, Virginia. This is Jean Barta with the Custer's Luck Radio Show. I just now spoke about the Battle of Namazine Church, where George Armstrong Custer's younger brother, Thomas, was very heroic and did some things that would allow him to be awarded the first of two Medals of Honor. I'm going to be right back, and then I will transition into talking about the Battle of Sailor's Creek. I'll be right back in about a minute. With the Custer's Luck Radio Show, and I'm glad to be here this evening And now what I'm going to do is talk about the Battle of Sailor's Creek. Let me go back to let you know that guests can call in at 646-787-8231. And they can also join me online via the Blog Talk Radio website. Guests who choose to go online simply need to key in Custer's Luck or Custer's Luck Radio Show, and my episode and show pages will come up. I will also let you know that this episode will be archived later this evening. On April 5, 1865, General Lee found his hoped-for route south along the Danville Railroad blocked by General Crook's cavalry at Jetersville. Lee's army continued west in search of rations expected at Farmville, but the trains had been diverted to Appomattox Station by a Union ruse. En route to Farmville, two divisions under Bushrod Johnson and George Pickett, and under overall command of Richard Anderson, ran headlong into Union cavalry near a stream called Sailor's Creek. Custer's division came on the field moving toward a road junction, Marshall's Crossing. They first encountered skirmishers guarding some Confederate supply wagons, which had been put in the front of the column to protect it from Union forces harassing the rear. Custer drove the train and its escorts back toward a stone wall across an open field near the road, behind which crouched waiting rebel infantry from Pickett's division. General Pickett wrote that his men were weary, starving, and despairing when they reached Sailor's Creek from Five Forks, and for 48 hours, the man or officer who had a handful of parched corn in his pocket was most fortunate. But Pickett's men still had some fight left in them. As the cavalry galloped near, the rebels opened fire in a fusillade that made many a rider bite the dust and set the whole column staggering back, Chaplain Humphreys recalled. George Armstrong Custer, however, was not the kind of leader to be balked at by a single defeat, and as soon as he could form his men again, he made the assaulting column more solid by doubling it and then sent it up the slope at a gallop. Away we went, wrote E.G. Marsh of the 15th New York Cavalry, with our sabers swinging at our wrists, ready to grasp at a moment's warning, and our carbines in an advance, ready for use. We had not gone more than 40 rods when the rebels opened fire upon us from 3 points with grape and canister, solid shot and shell, and musketry. This charge, too, was futile. The assault withered as it reached the wall, the men flung back and forceless fragments of defeat of valor, and the earth strewn with death. But the enemy was before Custer, and he meant to break him. He again doubled his force, lined them up across the field, and rode the length of the line to show his men he was with them. Drawing his sword and putting spurs to his steed, Custer dashed along the front of the whole line of serried soldiery, Chaplain Humphreys wrote, his brown sombrero turning up its broad brim from his brown forehead, his yellow curls floating on the wind, the ends of his crimson cravat flying like tongues of fire over his shoulders, his face aflame with the eager joy of battle. Custer seemed utterly oblivious to danger and to bear a charmed life amid the shower of bullets, and gave us an inspiring example of death-defying valor. Custer bade the band to play Yankee Doodle and led the masked cavalry toward the rebel redoubt. There had been no cavalry charge during the war which has surpassed that of Custer's in this attack, in energy and power, one news report read. It was terrible to the foe. With sabers drawn, with horses upon the run, goaded by spurs and quickened by shouts till they caught the wild enthusiasm of their riders, till horses and men became fiery centaurs, the line swept on. The rebels loosed more grapeshot and musket fire on the rushing line of cavalry, inflicting more damage, but the mass of the attack was too great. Custer's men reached the rebel line and left the entrenchments, shooting and sabering all who resisted. George Armstrong Custer's brother, Captain Tom Custer, rode with him in this charge. Tom had enlisted as a private in the 21st Ohio Regiment in September 1861 at age 17. Another brother, Nevin Custer, had also joined up but was discharged for rheumatism. Tom Custer campaigned in the West in the first years of the war, participating in some of the major battles and serving briefly as an escort for General Grant. In October 1864, the older brother, George, petitioned to have Tom transferred to his command, and he was commissioned a second lieutenant in the 6th Michigan Cavalry, joining George in November 1864. Tom had fought by his brother's side since, having a horse shot out from under him at Five Forks, and as well, as I just described, capturing a rebel standard at the Battle of Namazine Church. Now, younger brother Tom thundered across the field, heading for the enemy works. And as George wrote to his wife, Libby Custer, later on, Tom led the assault on the enemy's breastworks mounted. He was the first to leap his horse over the works on top of the enemy while they were pouring a volley of musketry into our ranks. Colonel Capehart, who was a few feet away, saw the rebel color bearer of the 2nd Virginia Reserve Battalion raise a pistol and shoot Tom in the face at close range. The shot knocked him back on his horse, Capehart recalled, but in a moment he was upright in his saddle. Tom Custer grabbed the flag while drawing his revolver and shot the enemy infantryman in the chest, killing him. Tom rode back through continuing fire, seeking his brother George. The side of Tom's face was bloody and spotted with burned powder. An officer he had served with in the West saw Tom and exclaimed, "Why, you're wounded, man." "Not much," Tom replied, spitting out blood. He found his brother George, who had been unhorsed in the charge. "Armstrong," Tom said as he came up, "the damn rebels have shot me, but I've got my flag." George told Tom to go to the rear and have a surgeon attend to his wound. "Damn it, there isn't any rear," Tom explained, readying to charge back into the fight. George shouted at his brother to halt and gave him a direct order to seek assistance before he bled to death. For this fight and for his valor at Namazine Church, Tom Custer was awarded 2 Medals of Honor, the only soldier in the war to receive the medal twice for separate actions. By that point in the conflict, it had become a convention that soldiers who captured enemy flags would be so recognized, though it was the type of thing that George himself had done as a junior officer without receiving any medals. But George Armstrong Custer never begrudged his brother the honors. "Do you know what I think of him?" George wrote Libby after the fight. "Tom should have been the general and I the lieutenant." While George Armstrong Custer's cavalry was breaking the front of the Confederate column, General Wright's 6th Corps was battering the rebel rear, facing 2 divisions under Custis Lee and Joseph B. Kershaw, commanded by Richard Ewell. "The 6th Corps, changing direction, followed like hounds," a reporter wrote, "until the enemy, finding he could not get past Custer, turned on them again. It was a brutal fight. We were attacked simultaneously, front and rear, by overwhelming numbers," Stiles remembered. "And quicker than I can tell it, the battle of..." And quicker than I can tell it, the battle degenerated into a butchery and a confused melee of brutal personal conflict. I saw numbers of men kill each other with bayonets and the butts of muskets, and even bite each other's throats and ears and noses, rolling on the ground like wild beasts. A quarter of Lee's remaining force was lost, along with most of their supplies, and those who escaped death or captured were, quote, broken down, nearly famished, and mostly without arms. Observing the rout of his troops from a high point to the west, Robert E. Lee said to Major General William Little Billy Mahone, "My God, has the army dissolved?" On the side of one of the captured Confederate wagons, a rebel had written, "Williams had found the last ditch." 7,000 Confederates were captured, including 8 generals, among them Ewell, Custis Lee, and Kershaw. At the Federal field headquarters after the battle, Kershaw recorded that a spare, lithe, sinewy figure, bright, dark, quick-moving blue eyes, florid complexion, light-waving curls, high cheekbones, firm-set teeth, a jaunty, close-fitting cavalry jacket, large top boots, Spanish spurs, golden aiglettes, a serviceable saber, a quick, nervous movement, an air telling of the habit of command, announced the redoubtable Custer, whose name was as familiar to his foes as to his friends. General Kershaw presented his sword to George Armstrong Custer, saying, "I have met you on several occasions in battle, and I know of no officer to whom I would rather surrender my sword." But Custer refused the honor, asking instead that it be given to the corporal of the 2nd Ohio who had captured the general. Ewell also tendered his sword, as did others, but Custer took none of them. General Ewell said, "Further fighting is useless. It is a wanton waste of life." He told Custer that if a white flag were to be sent out, the 30,000 men in our army would surrender. But Custer said he had no authority to seek a truce. The Spanish spurs Kershaw noted Custer wearing may have been the pair loaned that day by captured Confederate artilleryman Colonel Frank Huger, a friend from the class of 1860. He was the son of Confederate General Benjamin Huger of the class of 1825. The intricately carved spurs originally belonged to Mexican General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna, and the elder Huger had received them from General Winfield Scott during the Mexican War. General Huger gave the spurs to his son Frank when he graduated from West Point. Young Huger was captured by his friend Custer at Sailor's Creek, and George kept Huger with him for the rest of the day, as he said, "To let you see how I am going to take you fellows in." Also among the prisoners was Brigadier General Eppa Hutton, a brigade commander in Pickett's division of the Hutton family, whose home, Cerro Gordo, had been Custer's headquarters during the October 63 debacle of Buckland Mills. Hutton was very sick and doubted he would survive imprisonment. Hearing about Hutton's condition, Custer sent his physician with a bottle of imported French brandy, Eppa recalled, and furnished me with a hair mattress to sleep on. He was as kind as a man could be, and I shall never forget his generous treatment. After the war, Hutton served as a member of Congress from Virginia, and Eppa's son recalled that when some charges against Custer were referred to the House Military Affairs Committee, Hutton became his chief defender. "I never saw him more deeply and earnestly interested than in Custer's defense," he recalled. "I think nothing came of the investigation and that the charges were never pressed." Also on the committee and with Hutton in the 43rd Congress was former Confederate cavalryman Pierce M.B. Young, elected from Georgia, who had traded meals with his friend Custer at Cerro Gordo the day of the Buckland races. Sheridan openly praised Custer for his conduct in the Battle of Sailor's Creek. He sent word of the victory to Grant, adding his opinion that, quote, "If the thing is pressed, I think Lee will surrender." Word came back shortly from President Lincoln, let the thing be pressed. This is Jean Barta with the Custer's Luck Radio Show. I'm going to take another break and be back. With the Custer's Luck Radio Show. Let me wrap up by talking a little bit about the casualties and other notable prisoners taken at the Battle of Sailor's Creek. General Humphreys reported 311 casualties in his corps and 442 in Wright's corps, but he had no way to state the numbers of casualties suffered by the Union cavalry. Historian Noah Andre Trudeau states the total Union losses were 1,180 killed and wounded. Humphrey stated that the total Confederate losses in killed, wounded, and captured was, quote, not less than 8,000. The historian Trudeau agreed with this number. He noted that despite the efforts of Anderson, Ewell, and Gordon, the greater part of the wagon trains were destroyed. Humphreys wrote, Ewell's whole force was lost, together with nearly half of Anderson's and a large part of Gordon's, all in a useless effort to save the trains. And again, at Sailor's Creek, about one-fifth of the remaining retreating Confederate army was taken prisoner or became casualties. Many Confederate officers were captured, including Generals Ewell, Kershaw, Custis Lee, Seth M. Barton, James P. Sims, Meriwether Lewis Clark Sr., Dudley M. DuBose, Eppa Hunton, and Montgomery D. Corse. Colonel Stapleton Crutchfield was killed leading a detachment of artillery personnel who had participated in the defenses of Richmond. General Humphreys also stated that disorder of the Confederates after the defeats at Five Forks, Sutherland Station, and the breakthrough in Petersburg doubtless scattered them to such an extent that many, being without rations, did not rejoin their command. He went on to say that, quote, in the movement to Amelia Courthouse and from that point to Sailor's Creek, Farmville, and Appomattox Courthouse, having but scanty supplies and being exhausted by want of sleep and food and overcome with fatigue, many men fell out or wandered in search of food. And interesting caveat and add-on pertaining to naming the battle. The current official name for the tributary of the Appomattox River is Sailor's Creek, spelled Sailer's, as established in 1959 by the United States Board on Geographic Names. This spelling is used on topographic maps issued by the U.S. Geological Survey. Many prominent Civil War historians, for example, James M. McPherson, Shelby Foote, Bruce Catton, Douglas Southall Freeman, etc., have used this spelling as of Sayler's. Chris M. Calkins of the National Park Service used that spelling in his 1980 work, 36 Hours Before Appomattox, and also in the nomination he wrote to preserve the battlefield in the National Register of Historic Places inventory. However, Calkins noted in his 1997 work, The Appomattox Campaign, that at the time of the Civil War and previously, maps used the spelling Sailor's, Sailor's. These maps included the 1752 Joshua Fry Peter Jefferson map of Virginia and the 1867 Mishra survey maps of 1867, which were included in the official records atlas. He therefore judges that the correct name for the Civil War battle should be Sailor's Creek, Sailor's Creek. The American Battlefield Protection Program, the Civil War Trust, and the Virginia Department of Conservation and Recreation used the spelling Sailor's, Sailor's. And in any case, the battlefield was designated a National Historic Landmark in 1985. This is Jean Bartow with the Custer's Luck Radio Show, and I will add that at the end of this, at the end of the battle, as I said, Sheridan openly praised Custer for his conduct, and he sent word of the victory to Grant, adding his opinion that, quote, if the thing is pressed, I think we will surrender. Word came back shortly from President Lincoln, let the thing be pressed. Sheridan had already moved. Cavalry and infantry that had not been engaged at Sailor's Creek continued to harry General Lee's men. And the day after the battle on April 7th, Sheridan pressed on with the rest. General Custer set off flying a red and blue silk banner with cross sabers, a personal standard that his wife Libby had sewn for him weeks earlier and that already bore the scars of battle from its glorious baptism at Dinwiddie Courthouse. Custer assembled a personal escort of men who had captured Confederate battle standards, bearing their trophies in ranks behind him. After Sailor's Creek, the Honor Guard carried over 30 rebel flags, and in the next few days they would have 40. Seeing Custer ride past with his colorful escort, an old soldier of the Sixth Corps observed, "Oh yes, my boy, you have picked up the apples, but the Sixth Corps shook the tree for you." As Custer set off in pursuit of the rebels, he passed General Kershaw and a group of Confederate prisoners and raised his hat to them. And Kershaw said, "There goes a chivalrous fellow. Let's give them three cheers." Custer then, in response, had his band strike up the unofficial Confederate anthem, the Bonnie Blue Flag, to the whoops and yells of the prisoners. And this is Jean Barta with the Custer's Luck Radio Show. I'm finished with my show for this evening. Thank you all for listening. And I will add that this show will be archived in a few minutes once I'm finished and I'm off the air. My next show will be Wednesday night, and I perhaps will tell you a little more about the events that are going to be taking place in Washington, D.C. this coming weekend to commemorate the grand review which actually took place in late May of 1865, and however is going to take place in commemoration on Sunday, May 17th. I will tell you a little bit more about that on my next show on Wednesday night. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll be back on the air around 7 o'clock on Wednesday evening this week. Thank you so much.